Alexander Hefner, your host on The Open Mind. You can follow us at Open Mind TV and support our series on Patreon at patreon.com/theopenmind. I'm delighted to welcome media scholar at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Talk Radio's America, How an Industry Took Over a Political Party That Took Over the United States. Brian Rosenwald is joining me today.
It's great to be with you.
Brian, I have to ask you from the outset to reflect on Rush Limbaugh's death. He's considered the originator and pioneer of the industry on which you have reported. What is your immediate reflection on his death?
It's incredibly polarizing. To the right, a hero has passed away, and a lot of people lost a friend, someone they spent hours with every week for 30 years. To the left, it is, good riddance to a hate monger. But I think that what we should be focusing on is that this man had a career that reshaped not only American politics in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, but also reshaped the media, took us from a media world in which four newspapers, three major television networks, CNN and the wire services dominated the media, and journalists could serve a gatekeeper function, to a world in which a lot of people get their information from what I call infotainment programming, which blends information and entertainment. And the key is that the hosts are trying to put on a good show. They're not journalists. They don't have to worry about facts and getting things right to the same extent. They're just putting on a good show. The goal is to grab the audience. And Limbaugh, pioneers that, and he pioneers broadcast conservative media, and he completely changes the media. And he also has, transformed the Republican Party. He's led to a much more polarized politics with much greater gridlock and less functionality from our government. So I think we should focus on his significance, because we're never going to agree on the kind of moral implications of his career and his life.
Let's talk about the significance. You point out he was a precursor to Fox News. He was also a precursor to an entertainer in chief rather than a real commander in chief in Donald Trump. So to understand his impact historically, you really have to appreciate the context of the void and talk radio's emergence really as a counterbalance to the mainstream news and the assertion of the ultimately demolished fairness doctrine that you ought to have fact-based discourse.
Yeah, I think what happens is there's nobody who sets out who says, oh, there's this huge audience out there for conservative broadcast media. There was no visionary, clairvoyant person in the late 80s who hit on things. Rush Limbaugh gets identified and taken national because he's an enormously talented broadcast entertainer. He's someone who's been a DJ and has applied the shtick that he kind of honed while he's playing Elton John records in the 70s and Beatles records to the discussion that he heard around the dinner table growing up. When he goes to Sacramento, where he really starts his ascent in 1984, he's not even registered to vote. We're talking about a guy who is not that political, who says people listen to the radio for three things: entertainment, entertainment, entertainment. And he goes on the air, and all of a sudden people start calling in and saying, thank God you're on the air, Rush. We finally have a voice. There's somebody to speak for us. There's someone to, stand up for us. And these are Americans who felt like their values were being trampled on, and they felt like they were being condescended to. And they felt like the mainstream media was one organ that was kind of trampling on those values, wasn't reporting on stories they thought were important, was, beholden to liberal interests. And we should be clear, the idea of the mainstream media as a liberal media holds from a cultural perspective. There is definitely a cultural orientation where journalists come from kind of liberal circles. They have more educational attainment. They tend to be based in places where they're surrounded by other liberal professionals. And it does affect what questions they ask and what things they think are news. But it is not the equivalent of what Rush Limbaugh ended up pioneering, which is in-your-face, perspective-driven conservative media. His show was about his opinions. It was not about interviews. It was not about callers. It was about what did Rush think on that given day. And it was driven by his political perspectives and his values. And that was something very, very different. It was not a comparison, but it filled that niche. It filled that market need. And that's something that was, you know, no one identified until after it came along, but it shaped so many programming decisions subsequently.
I do want to nail you down on this question of fact-based discourse versus values that might actually be driven by fabrications and bigotry. When he started, how fact-based was the program? How many of his listeners were gravitating to him for a racist or bigoted approach?
Well, I think, first of all, Rush Limbaugh never shied away from saying things that were racist, that were misogynistic, that were homophobic. He never shied away from pushing boundaries and often going well beyond them. You know, in his first years on the national airwaves, he did AIDS updates that were, you know, making fun of people who were dying. And he ended up apologizing for it because he came to realize it was really crass and cruel and wrong. So he never shied away from that stuff. But I think that the appeal from that end was more that he could say things that people had said, that people used to freely joke about, and that the norms had changed. The rights movements of the 60s and 70s had changed societal values so that people couldn't say what they once could have said. And those people didn't necessarily change. And they were looking for someone who could say the things that they were like, oh, I can't say that anymore. Someone's going to accuse me of being a bigot. It might even be their own kids. And so he kind of gave voice to that. So that's definitely one element of the appeal. In terms of fact-based, I think his show got less factual over time, believe it or not. He was never averse to a good conspiracy theory. He was never all that, you know, preoccupied with fact-checking or getting things right. He would get something in some of his, you know, earlier years, like he would see something on a CompuServe message board or get something, you know, faxed to him and would breathlessly share it on the air, even though it was, you know, complete hogwash. You know, there was one time he brought the market down when he reported that he had gotten some tip that, you know, Vince Foster was actually murdered in an apartment owned by Hillary Clinton. So he was never averse to any of that stuff. I think it got worse with time because in those early days, almost all of the news he was sharing, when he would read from a newspaper article in his, you know, formerly nicotine-stained fingers, he would say, that he was holding and he would rustle the paper, it was from the Times or the Post or the Wall Street Journal, you know, or even, you know, National Review. Whereas by the end of his, you know, career, it was from Breitbart or Gateway Pundit or, you know, the Federalist, these far right sites where they have no commitment to facts. So, you know, almost, I wouldn't say unwittingly, but unintentionally, I think he got even less factually based with time. You know, I always say to people that if you want the conservative or the liberal equivalent to what Rush Limbaugh was doing in his early years on the national airwaves, the better comparison is not the nightly news, it's the Daily Show. It's something where you might get some, you know, information, but the goal is to put on a good show. The goal is not, you know, there's no editing process. There's no, you know, it's got to go through three editors and fact checkers and things. That none of that existed for his show. He was the sole decider of what went on the air. And it was, you know, much more of a, he did stand up on the weekends. He went to affiliate cities, put on a tuxedo and did like a kind of stand-up act. So he was much more entertainer or comedian than fact-based journalist.
Right, in that first part of his career. But as the racism and bigotry became more dominant as like the central motif and imperative, was it a supply or a demand that precipitated the acceleration or escalation of that racism for it to become a mode of radicalization and indoctrination? So we went from innuendo and sometimes ad hominem, you mentioned directed at AIDS patients or the homosexual community, to legitimizing an insurrection, a literal terrorist attack on one branch of the American government.
So I'm not sure that the show got more racist or more bigoted with time. I think it was pretty consistent in that regard. I think values, our values moved to the left as a society. So he got called out, and rightfully so, for things he did more in his later years. I think what ended up happening was stuff that he could maybe get away with in parodies early on, that where people would say, God, that's terrible, but were sort of laughing in spite of themselves and their own values. As he became more of just a straight up commentator, it became harsher. The tone was less jocular. It was less fun. It was less funny. So I think that kind of rubbed off. And I think the reasons for that transformation were threefold. One, a lot of the themed updates and the skits and things he did in the early years were really boundary pushing things. And advertisers, as it became a bigger and bigger deal, got nervous about that stuff. They were worried that it could offend to a greater extent. And you're saying, well, wait a second, his political commentary offended. But, realistically, there were a lot of conservative commentators who said a lot of things that the left found offensive, but were not, outrageous in the sense that, that corporate America would revolt against it. Secondly, he had all these people calling in and saying, we finally have a voice. You have this, and he felt this growing responsibility to serve them. And so that was the second piece. And then he sort of indicated on either his 20th or 25th anniversary on the air, that stuff was a young man's show and it wouldn't feel right for a man in his 60s. We have to think about the longevity of the show. He did this for 32 years or 32 and a half years on the national airwaves. So I think that that's the first part of that answer. But the second part and the key to it is it's absolutely demand side because Rush Limbaugh would say his goal was to charge confiscatory advertising rates. He is a master businessman. He built this empire. And one thing that talk radio hosts do inordinately well is to have their finger on the pulse of their audience. They know where the audience is. And as the audience got more and more disgruntled, as Republicans had unified control of government and made promises because they understood what their base wanted to hear, so they throw them rhetorical red meat, but it didn't reflect the realities of governance. And hosts stoked this and made it worse as well, because hosts would be like, well, they should be fighting harder for you. They should be doing more. And that didn't reflect the nuance of what was required by governance and having power. And so... as there was more anger in the audience, and simultaneously, conservative media is expanding by leaps and bounds in the digital age. And so there's more commercial pressure. These guys are getting buffeted.
What do you think was driving that? If specifically, the way that Rush Limbaugh would discuss President Obama or candidate Barack Obama. Is it that the nation became more racist as it sort of started listening to talk radio and the fairness doctrine or certain norms of discourse that were on broadcast were abandoned? I'm trying to get at the source of what was driving the escalation in that direction.
I don't think so. I think it comes down to the simple fact that as conservatives lost the culture wars, there was a book recently about the culture wars a couple of years ago where the conclusion actually said, conservatives have lost this. Obviously, they're still going on and they're fighting harder. And I wouldn't necessarily agree with that conclusion. But conservatives lost round after round for decades in the culture wars. And it made them angrier and angrier. And at the same time, you get this expansion of the commercial marketplace where you get more and more conservative hosts. And no host wants to be accused of having gone soft. No host wants to have people calling up and saying, well, I read this, and the host said, well, that's not true. That's a conspiracy, or that's, wrong, or Breitbart is off, on a different planet. Then the caller's going to say, well, what happened to you? You used to be one of us. When did you go soft? Why are you the establishment now? So I think a lot of this was commercial pressure. And I do think that what these hosts stoked was less increased racism as increased anger, increased fury, increased feeling of kind of disenfranchisement and voicelessness, where they'd say, these Republicans are all rhinos. The idea of what a rhino was, a Republican in name only, went from being legitimate liberal Republicans when Limbaugh went on the air in 88, Northeasterners, to moderate Republicans, to mavericks like John McCain, who were actually conservatives, but who would depart from Republican orthodoxy on a few positions, to people like John Boehner, who at the beginning of time were the original kind of like conservative rebels in the early 90s. So I think you have this building anger, and I think that you have, you know, where I think that they kind of maybe fuel racism and increase racism is around immigration more. But I think that what I always say is people see sometimes the talk radio audience as kind of puppets that are being led around by these hosts. I don't think hosts do anything other than tapping into long-seated, you know, feelings that people already have, and maybe applying them to issues and personalities that the audience wouldn't otherwise know about.
The issue in 2020 was the destabilization of democracy, right?
Absolutely.
And so I want you to comment on his ultimate legacy, which in Donald Trump's mind was being someone who legitimized the insurrection and who wanted to deny the franchise. It's interesting how you're describing a movement that was born out of resentment and feeling of disenfranchisement. And four decades later, if not longer, there is actually a political authoritarian movement to disenfranchise. So from being disenfranchised to actually being the ones disenfranchising others.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you have here is a perception versus reality gap. These people felt very disenfranchised while simultaneously, you know, being the majority and maybe at the beginning. And now they feel, they sense that they're a minority, right? Republicans have won the popular vote once since 1988. And they understand that their, you know, meal ticket is suppressing the vote, right? If more people show up to vote, that's not good for them. Or at least that was the sort of standard thinking before Donald Trump, you know, brought out increasing numbers of white working class voters. But I do think that absolutely the legacy of Rush Limbaugh, the legacy of conservative media more broadly has got to reflect the fact that we got to this point of having an insurrection, of having these people legitimately trying to overthrow the American government to some extent and overthrow a democratic judgment in an election because of this fusion of, you know, information with the kind of idea of good putting on a good show, where misinformation becomes a big part of what they're doing. Where in the last, you know, especially the last decade, it's gotten much worse, where the people they are spotlighting is like Republican heroes. The guys, you know, talk radio is a soap opera, and the heroes in it became people like Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows, exactly the kind of people who Donald Trump surrounded himself with. And Donald Trump is really, you know, tapping into the ethos of talk radio. He takes their playbook every day. People say, Donald, you can't say that. And he says, oh, yes, I will, and punches them right back in the face. He has, you know, caustic nicknames for the media. That comes straight from Rush Limbaugh and other hosts who've been doing this for decades. You know, the misinformation, the anger, the kind of, you know, every bit of his act was very much like a talk radio host. And they had spotlighted the people who are peddling misinformation. They had, you know, freely embraced the spread of misinformation themselves. And so after the election, it was just, you know, logical. They're not going to get askance of their audience. These guys know where the bottom line is. They know where their money is. And so they were going to spread these lies. They were going to spread this misinformation. You saw it on Fox News. You saw it with Limbaugh. You saw him still kind of peddling this even down to his very final shows. And that is fueling the, you know, the insurrection. So it's absolutely part of the legacy. It's absolutely part of the toxic political climate that we have today. In which the Republican Party is just a train wreck. And they're engulfed in a civil war between the far right and the even further like populist far right that doesn't care at all about facts. And in which our government is really only somewhat functional.
Knowing that these talk radio hosts at the outset were more in the realm of entertainers, if you were to go into the mindset of Limbaugh and think of the degrading effect of that disinformation on the election process and the insurrection and being a cause of that insurrection, Did he at all, or would he have, even if it was privately, separated himself from the even more extremist and domestic terroristic element of the QAnon, which is, when you describe the scales of extremism, which is Limbaugh on steroids as an explicit political movement? Would he say privately he would not associate with Q, or would he credit himself for basically being the generator of Q and a real political movement that would impose the will of conservatives, even if it was in an undemocratic, authoritarian means?
Well, I'd separate the two. I think Limbaugh, I think Hannity, I think most of the mainstream of conservative media didn't really want to touch QAnon. That was actually a bridge too far, because that was something that the corporate headquarters was not going to like. That was something advertisers were not going to like. So I think that that was something they wouldn't engage in. Now, when we're talking about the insurrection, when we're talking about, anti-democratic movement, I don't know that they would have denounced, separated themselves from that as much. I think there was a certain amount of tongue in cheek to what Limbaugh did. He used to love to say something and then everybody would get outraged. And he'd say, if you check the transcript, I did not say that. And you go back and you look and he would say, well, I saw this article where so-and-so wrote this. Or, he said in December, I think we may be heading towards secession. And then everybody got angry and he said the next day, I never advocated for it. I never did this or that. And it's true. He just mused about the possibility. So he definitely knew where, he absolutely could not go. But I don't think, in so much as we're talking about anti-democratic, I think that based on the fact that he was a 70-year-old white male when he passed away, that he probably bought a lot of this stuff about voter fraud and about, the need for stricter voting restrictions and all of that. I don't think that he would have said, that's so anti-democratic or anything like that. He was someone who fundamentally fit, very comfortably in this conservative world and milieu that he helped to create. And I think that over time with a lot of these hosts, even who might have initially, there was a lot of tongue in cheek stuff, I think it's hard not to buy in when you do it for as long as he did it.
You mentioned advertisers, sponsors, and executives. We know now that Smartmatic, Dominion, other owners of and managers of the election systems are suing those disinformers, those people who maliciously, deliberately dis and misinformed the electorate in the aftermath of this past November's election. Were he alive and healthy, he could well be a target of that suit. But it raises a larger question. Why was Limbaugh never defunded, and he never really faced the kind of pressure campaign over the last 4 years that some of his peers in extremist or conservative Trump loyalist media did?
I think first and foremost, conservative talk radio has flown below the radar to a large extent. It's less below the radar today than it was 25 years ago. When he first goes national, less than a year later, George H.W. Bush goes into the White House. And I talked to people on the communications team for George H.W. Bush, and they weren't even 100% sure they could hear Limbaugh's show in the White House. If you wanted to record Limbaugh in those days, and your younger listeners may be confused by this, but you had to get something called a cassette. And you had to put it in and you had to hit play and record at the same time and record it. There was no online streaming. There was no media monitoring. If you didn't hear it in the moment and you weren't tuned in, you kind of missed what he said. And he got himself more in trouble with the rise of streaming and monitoring and things because it was easier for people outside of his audience to hear. And advertisers didn't go away because the audience was there. It was tens of millions of people and they bought things. So that kept, advertisers to some extent aligned. He lost a significant number of advertisers after the Sandra Fluke imbroglio about 10 years ago for testifying in favor of birth control at a congressional hearing. And there was this huge blowback because he was punching down at a student and everything like that. But I think over, you know, even today, it's easier to monitor what Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity says on Fox News at night than ever was to monitor a 3-hour radio show. And even Limbaugh, who posted transcripts of his segments, they were not necessarily like you had to read the whole segment. It would take time. You wouldn't necessarily get to the blood and the guts, or if you didn't read the whole show, you wouldn't find something. And these were much longer shows. So I think a lot of it was that. I also think that realistically, there was money to be made. He was still making Premier Radio and iHeartMedia a lot of money, and he was making his advertisers money. And I think that kind of limited some of the fall. And in terms of lawsuits and things like that, I think Rush was remarkably good at knowing exactly what he could get away with saying without getting sued and exactly what he couldn't say.
Did you get a sense ultimately of how many of Limbaugh's listeners were also QAnon followers or posters? What was the intersection in 2021 of Limbaugh's listeners and the other cohorts of the Trump loyalist movement?
I don't know specifically, but I would think that there's a pretty significant overlap between conservative media consumption more broadly and QAnon following, because like I said, the stuff is marinated in misinformation. It's marinated in conspiracy theories. It kind of opens the doorway to going down these online communities. It's not a huge jump from Limbaugh to Gateway Pundit and then from Gateway Pundit or something like that to QAnon. So I think that there's probably a significant overlap, but I haven't seen any real research on that.
If there is one thing that the Democrats or liberals can do in the void of Limbaugh to reassert any kind of competition on radio, what is it?
I think they need to find people who put on good shows and give the audience something unique and interesting and entertaining and get a sense of what that audience wants. I think the problem with the radio has been that they've tried to replicate what they hear in conservative media, and that's not what the fans are seeking or hear in conservative media. And I think you see the mirror image in late night comedy where liberals have kind of dominated there. So I think they need to find good showmen, people who can go on and hold an audience who are really interesting and then give them an opportunity, have enough of a stable financial backing for them so that they can build an audience. It took Limbaugh a couple of years in some markets. So I think you need that kind of financial cushion. And I think you need to have people who have real talent. And once you have a couple of those people, then you can build entire stations and formats around them. So I think that that would be the real key to doing it, and you need that investment.
Brian Rosenwald, media historian and scholar, thank you so much for your insight today.
It's my pleasure to be with you. Always happy to do it.